I'm David.
And I'm Matt.
And you're listening to the Mastering Mondays podcast.
Here, we dive into the world of Microsoft and explore how it can help you, whether you're a business, an education provider, or an individual trying to make the most of the suite of Microsoft apps available.
Want to improve efficiency, boost profitability, master Microsoft's product range, or simply learn from some of the most valuable Microsoft experts who are sharing their stories with us? Then you're in the right place.
Welcome to the Mastering Mondays podcast, brought to you by No More Bad Mondays. Welcome to episode 20 of the Mastering Mondays podcast. Today, we're absolutely buzzing to have Microsoft Business Applications MVP Mark Smith joining us. Mark's a powerhouse in the Power Platform and Dynamics space. He's not only a certified trainer, but also the mastermind behind the popular 90-day mentoring challenge, all through his platform, nz365guide.com. With over two decades of experience actively contributing to the Microsoft community, Mark brings a wealth of knowledge to the show. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Thank you. Thank you. Good to be here, Matt.
What stands out for me about you, Mark, is I did some research before the show and I was going through your LinkedIn profile and looking at, you know, all your past experience. And it's really clear to see that you've made a significant or massive impact on the tech industry so far. You've worked with IBM, with Microsoft. You've been a board member of Microsoft Communities New Zealand, you know, and the list goes on. So I guess if you could take a second to think back on your career and your experiences, could you take a moment to tell us about it? How did you get started in tech and what led you to where you are right now?
Yeah, sure. So out of high school, I never went to university. I became a groundskeeper. I mowed lawns and I did that for 3 years. And it was in that groundskeeping job that I bought my first computer. So computers were starting to be a thing. And it was a Tandy computer, a 286 from memory. So the operating system was MS-DOS. So we're talking pre-Windows. And my brother lived in Denmark. He was quite a bit older than me. And he sent me floppy disks, and on them was Wolfenstein. And so you imagine a game, first-person shooter, that you could install from floppy disks. I mean, you know, nowadays, you know, Grand Theft Auto or anything like that, they're like gigs and gigs of, you know, data. Of course, much different experience. So, you know, that got me hooked. Back then, 2400 baud modem, you know, it would clang away, you'd get onto bulletin boards, that was it. And I pulled that computer apart multiple times, I reformatted it, I mucked up the drivers. You just went by trial and error, right? You'd always start back with your MS-DOS floppy disks and go and reinstall and work out what mistakes. But there was like no internet to jump on or anything, you know, as such back then. But that computer was $6,500, you know, and crazy, crazy number to pay for a computer, right? And back then, but that's what I used my groundskeeper money. So I went into another career into the medical industry, did that for 7 years. I was at that company and the internet, you know, had come about. And so they needed a website. And I'm like, hey, I could build a website. And so there was this training company and I went along because they taught, I think it was called PageMaker back then from Microsoft, had this little WYSIWYG type, you know, because I didn't know HTML or CSS or any of that type of stuff. And so as I got into it more, there was a web design course, a proper web design, so the holistic end-to-end out of America. And so I said, hey, I want to do that course. And they're like, ah, we don't have an instructor for it. We don't have, you know, we don't really, we can get it. We can get this course into New Zealand, but we don't really have it. And so I end up joining that company. I sold the first classroom of all the students onto that course. And then I was the trainer. So I went on these nighttime calls to the US. This was my first exposure to working out a time zone. I did train the trainer, training for this web design course. And then that started my career really in tech. So then I spent the next 7 years I did my first NT4 certification. Windows was, you know, taken off. Windows 95 had come out, and got heavily into a thing called internet working, which is really explaining how data moves from your network card, because back then you didn't have wireless, right? Network card or computer, how it kind of went down what was called the OSIRM, which is the international standards for how you moved a bit of information from one machine to another anywhere in the world. And so that was my foray into tech. I left that company, started my own. So I went there, I was there for 7 years. Went from being that junior role to being the general manager of the company. Got heavily into Sun Microsystems at that time, so which was quite a different sphere because that was all used by the enterprise, like all your banks and stuff. I'd been used to selling, classes or delivering classes that were, let's say, $2,500 a week back in those days. If you did an NT4 certification, you became a system engineer or a database admin were the kind of two premium certifications from Microsoft, which would be about 7 exams all up, much more lengthy compared to the exams we do nowadays in the Power Platform space. And then, started my own company. And the company was to do Dynamics because at that company in my final years there, I was customer one in New Zealand for Dynamics CRM. It wasn't even called Dynamics CRM back then. It was called MS CRM back in those days. So it was version 1.2, and this is in 2003. And that brings me up to like 21 years now spent in this space of low code, because really, MS CRM was low code. It was, you define the name value pairs and where you wanted them on a form. And as I built then my own company in that space, I quickly got into the situation where we were building apps for companies that weren't using CRM. They were using the product, but we were never doing customer relationship management. We were building a totally new piece of tech on that was just low code. And so we talk about, since 2016 when Microsoft bought out Power Apps, Project Sienna, I think it was called back then, is we talk about low code being a big deal now, but it's been low code for a heck of a long time. And what we call Dataverse now was just really Dynamics 365 with no head on it, right? It was that core infrastructure of compute, storage, API access to build any type of application. And so, it took me to Australia. I built a practice twice as large as our closest competitor in Australia just doing Dynamics CRM. So I had 70-odd consultants in that team working for me, built it from sub-million dollars to $25 million in 3 years. Then my wife and I decided to go and explore the world. We'd had 4 deaths in the family within 1 year. And we're just like, the more I worked, the more they wanted me to work, And there's no concept in business that, hey, you've hit your target, take the rest of the year off. And so every year I'd smoke my targets. I would generally do my entire annual target in 1 quarter. The first year was 5 million. The next target next year was like 11 million. Then it was 21 million. And I always completed them with months to spare on the year. And all I wanted from this company was give me more time off. I don't want more money. I want time off. I want freedom. And of course, no company has that concept, right? The better you do, well, we'll just up your targets next year. Do you want some more money? I don't want more money. I want more freedom. I resigned. They said, hey, don't resign. Just take a sabbatical. And from that, my wife and I traveled to the UK. And we traveled right across Russia, Europe, multiple countries, China, kind of all Northern Hemisphere locations. And halfway through that, the company that I was working for in Australia was sold to a Japanese company. And I was like, hey, I had a restraint of trade on me and stuff like that. I didn't want to go back to that. So I resigned in London, sent off to HR, resigned. And 72 hours later, it was all confirmed. You know, I was the resignation had been accepted, and I posted on LinkedIn and said, "Hey, I'm still on sabbatical, but I have resigned from this company that I was working for. You know, I want to make sure there's no restraint of trades on me or anything when I return to Australia." That post was at that time my most successful post ever on LinkedIn. I think 70,000 views. I was made job offers by Microsoft New Zealand, Microsoft Australia, Microsoft UK, and the US. I was offered jobs in every continent except for Antarctica. I was offered VC money to start a new business. And I was like, oh my gosh, I never realized, like little old me in New Zealand, I didn't realize how much of a personal brand I had created globally and that people are watching, observing and stuff. And that really was, that was a massive tipping point for me just to realize the importance in your career. If you're going to stand out, you need to be different. You can't just work a CV and think that's how you're going to stand out in the modern world. You have to have a digital home, a digital footprint, and you have to share your ideas so that people can either go, that idea sucks, or that idea is awesome and I want to get on board with it. And so I've been really doing that ever since.
I love your point there on the more you work, the more they want you to work. I mean, that's so true. You can never complete. You can never, you can't complete a job, can you really? You're always going to be asked for more.
So Mark, tell us about the 90-Day Mentoring Challenge. This is your hugely successful program that has reached more than 1,200 people, probably more than that now, in 70 countries, probably more countries too. What is the program and what inspired you to set it up, and what do people learn when they join the program?
I like it. So it started when I was living in London. So after that big tour of the world, my wife, she landed a job at Google London. She had worked for Google Australia before we went and took that year, which ended up being 18 months that we ended up traveling. So I'm in London, I'm freelancing, and when I only had one customer, and that customer was Microsoft in Seattle that I was freelancing for. And I kept getting asked by people on LinkedIn particularly, would you mentor me? And it was quite, often. And so what happened is that I looked at who in the industry was doing mentoring in business applications. And what I noticed is, and I even met with these people, I talked with them. There was one guy, Mustafa, in the UK particularly, that mentors a lot of people. And all of the mentoring was always in person. So it had a geography constraint on it. And then the other thing is, as I thought about this, is that what about if you didn't have a local person that could mentor you? What if you're in a remote country? And I often use Nigeria as an example. What if you're in Nigeria? Who's going to mentor you there? And we're talking about 2017, 2018. And I was just like, you know what? I'm going to scale, because I don't ever like to do, freedom is my word. That's my defining word. How freedom, and that means time freedom, ultimately. And how do I scale this? How do I make it, one, accessible to anybody in the world? Two, how do I scale it so there'd be unlimited number of people? So you got to think, this is all pre-pandemic. This is pre-everybody doing Zoom calls or Teams calls or anything like this. And I decided, you know what? I'm going to do it in, I think it's Skype for Business. No, it was Zoom. I used Zoom back then. You know what? And I just put it out there. I think it was a Thursday. I just put it on LinkedIn. Who wants to join me? I'm going to do this thing with the 90-Day Mentoring Challenge. I called it 90-Day from day one because I've always had a bent for marketing and stuff, and that anything should be searchable in a search engine, right? If I just said it was going to be business applications mentoring program, that is just too benign and generic and it just gets lost in the wash, you know? So I came up with 90-Day MC from day one. And I think about 40 people joined it, mainly from the UK, but definitely European, you know. And I only, I did a whole brainstorming around what I should cover. And I went out to a whole bunch of MVPs all over the world and said, you know, if I was to do this, what do you recommend? What should I talk about and stuff? What became very clear is that there's heaps of technical content out there, heaps of people writing blogs, doing YouTubes and Microsoft Learn and stuff like that, that do the technical, but nobody was focusing on how do I get ahead of my career? How do I stand out in my career? How do I excel as a consultant? How do I get really good? How am I going to get career progression? What does that even look like for me? And so I decided, and I just went through a mind map process, and out of it came kind of what I distilled down to 6 topic ideas. The first one being communication, the second one being an effective consultant, the third one being understanding the Microsoft landscape. Then there was a career module on what are all the career paths that you could do. And there was one on personal branding. And one on community. So those were kind of the modules that I did, and I ran them all live.
So can I just stop you there, Mark? So just to ask you a question. So you're trying to get a better work-life balance, and you set up a pan-global business that you deliver live.
But I mean, I had stopped working corporately at that time, you know, so I did have a bit more time on my hand. But yeah, it was scalable. But it was crazy.
It must have been crazy.
And it took off, you know, as in I did it that year. I did it for 90 days. And people would go, it kind of spread, like heaps of people became MVPs off the back of that first intake. And so then I was asked to do it the next year and the next year and the next year. And so I did it for 5 years. And it's funny how time flies, right? All of a sudden, 5 years has gone past. I got to doing it 2 time zones. So I would do it in the morning. I'd get up really early and deliver the morning session. Then at 12 hours later, I'd deliver the night session because I had moved back to New Zealand because of the pandemic and stuff had happened. And it was just like, hang on a second, a whole bunch of this, I am just repeating the same thing, just different. And like I'd have 100 people on screen, you know, as I was running this. And I made sure there's lots of hands-on, you know, so like it wasn't just a theory course, right? You had to go do if you're going to get value from this. And so, yeah, long story short, I did it for 5 years. I was then working at IBM, and I grew a community inside IBM of around 3,000 practitioners in the Power Platform space. So an internal community. And I stopped doing it in 2022. I don't think I did it, or 2023, I didn't deliver the 90-day mentoring challenge. And I had so many requests from people that had heard about it now at this point. But one of the things that had come out is that as I, you know, heard from folks more and more around the world, they were like, why are you doing this for free? Because all of that 5 years, no cost whatsoever. Anybody could join, no cost. And I was like, well, I wanted no barrier to entry. But more and more people, and I wasn't asking for this advice. They would tell you, like, one, you're devaluing it by making it free. German people, if something's free, they don't even interested in it because it can't be good. It must be rubbish if it's free. And so then it was a go, okay, well, so what do you price it at, right? And so comparable courses were generally around $2,500 type, you know, for this 90-day, you know, length of course like this, which we're meeting every fortnight for the 90 days. And I was like, I know there are people in parts of the world are never going to afford that. That's too big a stretch. And so the old price that I settled on was $499 for the course. And what I have noticed that since adding a financial piece to it, and people, for whatever reason, psychological reason, when they've put money in, they're much more committed to the journey. I had so many people that would start off with good intentions, and then, of course, life gets in the way. All of a sudden, you miss one call. Now you're 4 weeks behind because, you know, I was doing it fortnightly. And, you know, the whole fall off the wagon would since there's been a monetary component, oh my gosh, the stickiness of it has gone through the roof. So yeah, well over 40 people have become MVPs now that have gone through the program. As I say, well,
a couple of our guests, Mark, in fact, yeah. I recognize right? them. Yeah.
Is that right? Yeah. Is that right? Yeah. Yeah. So it is crazy. It's been an epic ride. It's now 12 modules. I go heavily into things like design thinking, change management. You know, the product set when I started, I was only focused on, Dynamics 365 from a CE perspective. And of course, now I have a lot of F&O people on. I have a lot of people now getting into AI and Copilot space. So it's pulling across more M365 folks. So it has definitely grown broader because it just focuses on these skills that everybody needs if you're going to be in tech that are not tech skills. They're all soft skills, or as one of my guests said, they're essential skills. If you learn these skills, you'll go a long way in your career and you'll be very effective as an individual contributor or a manager inside an organization.
Can I ask you, one of the words, an unusual word really in the context that comes up, I think you mentioned, I think some of your former students mentioned it as well, and that's about bringing the craft into your work, which is an unusual word in perhaps to use in this, in the context of this. What does that mean exactly?
So I use the word artisan. You know, being an artisan, and I look through history at how somebody became considered an expert in their field, their chosen field. And so if you go back, right, to, history, and of course, it was a male-dominated world back then, so it's very masculine-based, even the terms used. So you would be a boy, and you... maybe five years old, you would go and work at, let's say, the blacksmith shop. And you would go and you would sweep the floors, you'd make the cup of teas, you would be the runner, the dog's body type thing. You're doing it. And you did that for 7 years inside a business. But what happened, right, is that the tacit knowledge of how we do business, how we do our craft skill, you learnt it through years and years and years and years of exposure to it. What would happen then is that you could graduate and become a journeyman. And a journeyman was somebody that actually was skilled at the craft of whatever they did. Only when a journeyman had created a masterpiece could they become a, basically, how was a masterpiece determined? A masterpiece was determined with whatever craft you're in, you would build something. And then all the people that were already master craftsmen in your area, they would come together and they would look at your masterpiece and they would deliberate over whether it was a masterpiece. If it wasn't a masterpiece, you were back to the drawing board. You stayed as a journeyman. And back then, you weren't allowed to own your own business or start a company unless you're a master craftsman. It wasn't allowed, right? You had to actually create a masterpiece to be designated. And so we're talking about 15 years now before you could start your own business if you created a masterpiece. And so, you know, I converted that to artisan. I used a lot of reference to what Steve Jobs did in Apple, which was really about take pride in your work. Like, is it really quite, do you just do your job just to tick the box and go, hey, I did my 8 hours for the day or 10 hours or whatever it is you work? Or do you actually take pride in, do you think about your work, the person sitting in front of the bit of software you develop in 3 years' time, are they going, who the F built this? Or are they like, do they not even think about it? And I think if they don't think about it, you've probably done a good job. But if they're always frustrated with the field you placed on the screen, which was below the fold, I have to scroll down here, you made it a compulsory field, and that is frustrating. Why didn't you put it at the top of the page? Would have made it, like that type of thing. Do you think about that? Do you think about how people, I see you laughing, Dave, so I assume that you know what I'm talking about, right? Like no, some it's people just don't
I do
think,
it all the, I do it all the time, it, you know? Mark. I do it all the time. I need to come on your course.
And so it's really about taking pride in what you do. And I distill that down to value. Are you adding value? And do people, when they think of you in your career, do they think of there's somebody that I would want on my team? There's somebody that I can trust. And trust is a hard thing because I feel in the world we live in tech now, there's a lot of mistrust. There's mistrust between partners and customers. There's mistrust between Microsoft and partners. And there's mistrust between partners and Microsoft. Like, oh, they just want to sell the licenses where you want to do a project. And of course, the distrust is Microsoft, from Microsoft's side is, you're just wanting to sell hours. You know, you're not interested in selling the license, which is important to me meeting my KPI. And then the customer's going, do I need this? Or are you just trying to sell me more hours or more services or what? And so trust is, I think, something that a lot of people need to focus on a lot more because of there's a massive amount of, I think, distrust in the world at this time.
I think that's a really interesting answer. And I completely agree with it. I mean, the idea that actually you should be judged by aesthetics, all sorts of things that relate to your work rather than just really the cold kind of code that sits behind it. And it's a really valuable point. You know, as to whom that group of other craftsmen should be who should judge your work, is this the Microsoft MVP? Should you have to submit your masterpiece to them?
So this is what I did, is when I had my own company and I trained my staff in this, I would say, listen, who's the best judge of your work? And what's the default thing people say? The customer. And I'm like, no, the customer is ignorant. They don't know what good looks like, right? They don't work in this software every day, day in and out. So you can't say that a customer knows it because what they do is like, well, it's better than what we had, right? And that's not a measurement, better than what we had. So I would say back when I had my business in New Zealand, my number one competitor was a company called Intigen. They have now been sucked up and acquired and they're part of Capgem. And I would say if we took a consultant from Intigen and had him look or her look at your work, would you be afraid? Would you be like, oh, they'll see that shortcut I took or they can see I botched that? I said, you got to take a peer. It's got to be a peer, somebody that's been doing this as long. Doesn't have to be someone even further ahead than you, but as long as you've been doing it, could your work speak for itself or would you be embarrassed? I said, there's your test. Like, definitely, I wouldn't say an MVP. Not all MVPs are created equal. By any stretch. And so I definitely wouldn't use that as a measuring stick. It's somebody that's been on the journey as long as you have, can assess your work and in the same skill set area and be able to go, is this up to spec?
I want to dive into that a little bit more. You know, we're talking about trust. And I think one of the things that we should definitely be mentioning and we sort of have there is trust in an application or lack of trust in application. I've worked with plenty of organizations that, you know, they're using Dynamics, they're using Power BI, they're using Power Apps, and they're going, well, the data's wrong. All the data, it's not telling me what it should be telling me. It's a rubbish product. I'm going to go somewhere else. You know, so that is where there needs to be trust in the application, but also trust in the people that are using the application as well. And I think, you know, that for small to medium businesses and education providers that we kind of, you know, try and tailor this podcast for, that's when they often look at getting consultancy in to support them with, you know, with those applications and getting it to where it needs to be. I'm just wondering from sort of your experience as a consultant, how can businesses and again, education providers identify the right consultant that they might need, and even actually if it's necessary for them to engage with one, because it's really simple answer to go like, we need help with Dynamics. Okay, we're getting a consultant in. You know, do they really need one? Can they do a lot of this themselves through research, or is it, you know, dependent, I'm sure, on the type of thing you're trying to do, if you need to get a consultant in, and who should they get?
I love this. And you asked about three questions there.
Yeah, sorry.
So let's just unpick a few of those. So number one, you talked about data and the app sucks because really it's the data's wrong. My question to you is the Power Platform an app story or is it a data story? Now everyone thinks it's around building apps. but it's actually about data. It's a data orchestration platform, particularly Dataverse, right? And so the issue with most organizations is they've got bad data. And if I go back to 10 years of my career, I used to be an evangelist for a lot of Microsoft sessions with customers. And I talked about the four mega trends that were going to change the world. One of those mega trends was mobility. One was big data. And you need to collect data and look how much data we're collecting. And I think for the last 10 or 15 years, companies have got really good at collecting data. They've not been any good at curating data, right? So now they got vast amounts of this data. And of course, now AI comes into the mix and they're like, AI is shit. No, I think your data is. And that's why, you haven't gone through a change management process to use AI effectively. And that's why you get it. And I use this metaphor of if you were trained for 15 years in art, like Picasso, et cetera, and you create masterpieces in, with oils on canvas and stuff. And here I am. I pick up a paintbrush yesterday with the same set of canvas, the same canvas, the same brushes, the same oil. The result you're going to produce and I'm going to produce is going to be way different, right? Because one has had lots of practice, one hasn't. So I think that's important. Now going to this question on how do I know whether my consultant's any good? My second biggest post of all times was written this year on LinkedIn. So well over 85,000 views of this post. And the post was written after I had been to Slovenia to speak at the Dynamics Minds conference there. And the post was, the Dynamics partner is dead. And that went nuts, right? That went nuts. And I tell you what this was fueled from. I just spent 3 years working at IBM. And here's a dirty little secret of this consulting industry. Most of my career has been spent in pre-sales, right? So I go in and, as one of my colleagues say, I wave my jazz hands around and I translate technology to business and business to technology. And the customer, and I was just saying, I've just been on a call with a company in the Fortune 500 this morning at Sparrow. I did the session with the CTO. And I am bought in to show how tech works, but I'm not a salesperson, right? They never suspect me as a salesperson because I'm just, hey, the experienced person that can explain in business terms as technology. Of all those projects that I have been involved in the sales process on, how many of them did I actually then become part of the project team? None. I sat in governance roles, but I never was on the project team. And what these big consultant crowds do, so you name any name that jumps to mind when I say big global consulting crowds, they lead with their A team, they sell with their A team, and they deliver with their F team. Now, I didn't say B team, their F team. They deliver with graduates. And I have seen this all through my career, right? They put the lowest skill project, they make them learn on the job. They might put one senior consultant that oversees a project every now and again. That's how they build. Customers have got savvy to that. And what I am seeing more and more is customers are building their own teams. And we used to go, oh, no, that you can't do that. You don't have the expertise. Well, the other thing I've noticed is that so many consultants that have, earned their stripes, they've got 10 plus years in the industry. They know what they're doing, right? They know the tech. They've built their own skill set in the space, they are realizing they don't want to work on a timesheet anymore. They don't want to have to clock their hours every Friday and which customer's getting it billed for my time. And customers are out there going, you know what? You can just come and work for us. We don't have timesheets. And by the way, you'll have work-life balance a lot more than working in partner land because you can have time to learn on the job. And in partner land, I'm seeing utilization targets of 92%. I've seen utilization targets of 100% in the GSIs. So when do I learn? They go, well, you learn on your own time. And these are low-cost resources. So it's not like they're making coin, right? They are just, we could say sweatshop of IT. And customers are going, you know what? I can build my own team. I can bring in either independent contractors or bring on full-time FTE that just work for me and we'll build a team around them. And so on a lot of the large deployments, when I say large, you know, one project has involved 230,000 seats of Power Platform Premium in the Northern Hemisphere, another one 44,000 seats, another one 22,000 seats. These organizations are building their own teams. They use partner to augment a bit of that, but more it's resource augmentation, it's not outcomes augmentation, right? So what I've noticed in the last 10 years, most partners are no longer delivering a solution or an output. They're delivering bums on seats. Oh, you want a tech resource? Here's one. You want a security resource? Here's one. Are we delivering an output or a solution, which we were doing a lot more 10 years ago? We would own everything end to end as a partner. That's the world's moved on from that. And I think one, customers are getting savvy to this, that partners are just, they're wanting to put as many bums on seats and sell time, not sell outcomes. And I think that's why, how do I then find a good consultant? I think that's why the freelancing industry in our sector is taking off, because you're getting individuals that are building deep core expertise in one thing. They're across the Power Platform as a whole, but they might go deep on Power Pages, for example. Or they might become, you know, I am an automation expert or I'm a governance expert. And they built a brand reputation and market around that and they never want full work. So they're brought in because of their individual expertise into these organizations and a part of the entire team delivering a project.
I wonder if that's that applies more widely across multiple sectors, given the fact that in North America, for example, the huge rise in freelancers. I mean, you know, I guess the same motivations probably apply in all sorts of different sectors.
The founder of LinkedIn, Reid Hoffman, he has recently said by 2035, over 50% of the workforce will be freelancers. Now, what was crazy, when I talked about those megatrends back then, one of them would be is that people would have deep expertise, but they would work for multiple companies a year. They wouldn't just work for one employer. And we're really seeing that start to happen. Because if you want to make sure your project goes right and you want the best boots on the ground, why wouldn't you go and hire that individual now outside of the traditional company system to come in and bring to bear their deep expertise and know that I'm in safe hands for this piece of it? Takes more orchestration, right? Or your project leads or program managers are going to have to be able to wrap their arms around that. But I'm seeing that more and more. Like I'll give an example. A project I'm associated with at the moment, the customer was being invoiced $250,000 a week by the Microsoft partner. A week. They were quoted around $5 million to build something, X, and it was over $35 million when we were brought in as the strategic consultants to go, what has gone wrong? Guess what? The project hadn't even gone live.
My right? word.
How frustrated do you think that customer is? Right? And so what was the offer by the partner? Oh, listen, we'll reduce our rate to $150K per week to do a transition plan. We're like, nothing's live. You can just walk out of here and we will rebuild the entire solution for a fraction of what you are just routing this customer for. And like, that's one example that I'm touching at the moment. I know there's, you could multiply that by so many other companies around the world.
So you've got to be careful. You've got to be really careful.
Well, we do, yeah. There's, in one hand, we're dealing with much more savvy customer base, right? When I started to sell Dynamics CRM, it was hard work. Nobody even knew that Microsoft had a business suite of products. They were like, what? You just do the server and the operating desktop, right? And, you know, I can remember an insurance company in Sydney going into it, and they're just like, we've never even heard of Microsoft do any of these types. So you had to, one, sell that Microsoft did it. Two, sell that they had a business suite that could be taken seriously. Now Dynamics it's an accepted piece of tech, right? Nobody, generally in business, if you're dealing with a CTO or CIO, they know this technology. They've come across it in their career. So you're not trying to prove that this is a stable bit of tech. They're much more mature. And that's why I think that to a lot of degree, they don't necessarily need a partner.
I'm talking about, tech that maybe some people haven't heard of. You know, I'm going to ask you a question that we ask quite often because of its importance, not only to consultants and developers, but critically to smaller organizations looking to either keep up or get ahead. What areas are people focusing on at the moment? You know, which Microsoft products and services are capturing attention at the moment, and why are they?
AI, Copilot, right? As in, why is, if you've noticed the nomenclature coming out of Microsoft lately, they are saying we're an AI company, not a software company. We're an AI company. And I think what we're seeing, we're at the very, you know, we're still at the very dawn of AI from an adoption perspective. And AI is fundamentally, as in, if you know how to use AI, if you're a novice, you've typed in one prompt and you asked it a question like you would Google, you're not using AI right, you know? I would use AI multiple times a day now. It permeates every part and everything that I do. On my podcast, you know, as soon as AI became available on the Buzzsprout platform, which I distribute on, it gave me the choice to give me five titles for every episode. So I'd read the entire transcript and give me five titles. Now, up to that point, I would have, let's say, my MVP show, and I would go, it's Tom on the MVP show. It's Frank on the... Now, when you're looking at that, it's just like, wow, that's unique, right? That's a real compelling heading that's going to make me click and get into that episode. Now, because it's doing that, it's bringing up like, you know, Susie from Turkey talking about how she went from here to there. Like the title now is much more meaningful, and AI is doing that. The summary, the transcribing... You know, I remember when I used to have to pay $1 a minute for transcribing services. Now you just wouldn't dream of it, right? It's transcribed, and then all of a sudden now you can summarize. Now, you know, chapter markers in your podcast, all done by AI. This tool that we're using, Riverside, just phenomenal AI functionality in it to, you know, do I want to, from an editing perspective, do you want to remove all the pauses or filler words? And you've got four different settings. You can make it sound super crisp and punchy. You can make it a bit loose so it doesn't sound like, so we're only going to filter out, let's say, 50% of those. Just amazing advancements, you know, when it comes to that. And I've always said, you know, I've been working with Microsoft for technology as in, you know, the patent landscape for over 30 years, but 20 inside business apps. Always follow the technology that Microsoft is investing now, and your career will never end, right? Where are Microsoft pouring all their money? AI. So I know that if I pivot my career into AI, and I don't want to be a novice, I want to be a guru. That means I need to do a lot more than anybody else is doing in it. But also because AI is so prevalent outside of Microsoft as well, I think you need to get a rich understanding, because the risk is that if you just go with Microsoft's AI, you start listening to the marketing and you start believing the marketing, right? And you got to get beyond believing to knowing how it works, to knowing where the edges are, to knowing where you're on the bleeding edge rather than the cutting edge. And you can only do that through experience. And so I like to maintain when I open my browser, five tabs open. They are Claude, they're ChatGPT, they're two image generating, and then Napkin AI is the other one that I use because it allows me to create tech diagrams using AI based on my written content. So I am interfacing on my phone. I've got the app, and it's the one of five apps at the bottom of iPhone. It is AI, and it has been for a year and a half. It used to be the browser before the app became available. So I have permeated every part of my life, and I see the future is going to be squarely around those that understand and use AI effectively and those that don't. Here's one of the predictions I've made. Within 5 years, if you're a Power Automate consultant and you go under that moniker, I do Power Automate, in 5 years' time, you'll be irrelevant. There'll be no Power Automate consultants. Will Power Automate go away? Absolutely not. It's only going to get more feature rich. It's that the interface is going to be a chatbot. You're going to say, I need to automate this to this, watch my screen, do whatever. And behind the scenes, it's going to build out that flow for you. But we're not going to need you to actually build it out. That would not be good use of time. because the ability of the machine, the AI, to actually observe how you interact with that automation is going to mean that it's going to get improved straight away and constantly be improved. So I just think that a lot of what we do, and you think, Power Apps, why can't AI build all those for us? Already, the sophistication in the last 2 years has gone from being a single table to very limited to what we can do now is so much more. Where's it going to be, you know, in 2 years' time? I think it's how we interface with software, I think, will go massively towards voice as well. It's not saying we'll do away with keyboards. I think we'll go to a model where there's just going to be screens and you'll be able to go, hey, show that to me on such and such a screen there. But it'll be much more voice interactive. And so I want to get good at that before everybody else gets good at that, because I differentiate by doing that.
So do we think, would you say that the, you know, where we're going to be in terms of, say, 5 years' time, like you say, you know, you're not going to be creating your automations. You know, you're going to be knowing your business process, though, aren't you? Your specialist is going to know the business process, is going to know, you know, the most effective way for people to communicate, and how that can be augmented by or enhanced by you know, the available tools, I guess. What about the data side, though? So, you know, we talked about the fact that data is a barrier in many respects. If you have poor data, you've got poor curation of your data. In time, I'm assuming that AI will see its way through that to a degree, but you know, we speak to many people on the podcast, and almost all of them are kind of, yeah, data's a thing. You got to get your data right, and obviously that's clearly the case right now. But in time, can we see a point whereby AI is able to see its way through some elements of poorly curated data?
Yeah, I think we will have cleanup agents that go and sense making agents of data, right? And they will go through. So let's just take Google Photos as an example. If I look at my Google Photos, which has, you know, it's terabytes in size that I have in Photos, and a lot of the original photos came from, you know, scans of real photos, you know, that I had back in the day, in digital photos. And I've moved them from cloud provider over time, and I know there's a lot of duplicates in there. Have I got time to go through and look at all this? No, I'm not. I think that what will happen, and, you know, that we'll have AI that can go in and go, you know what, I'll look at the metadata of this photo, and I know that these two photos are identical. I'm going to clean up. Now, you take that inside an organization, same type of thing. I think that we're going to have a scenario that agents will be built that will go out and they will clean up the data inside the organization. Now, I mean it from a couple of perspectives. The two big risks inside organizations, one is not access to the right data. The data's there, it's just siloed, right? We haven't integrated to it. Two, the data is full of PII information. And where nobody knew or nobody could search or create a query to find that PII data, AI has an incredible way of understanding patterns and will be able to find it, right? It can connect the dots and go, hang on, this little snippet of data here and this little snippet of data over here and this little snippet, oh my gosh, I've got a 98% confidence that this is all the same person, and that person is X. That person is the CEO, and oh, what's their salary? Oh, here it is. Oh, when did they get a bonus? Oh, yes, here they did. When did they get their last pay raise? All of a sudden, right, AI is going to connect all those dots, and that's a problem because that's sitting. The data has always been there. It's just not been accessible because no one knew how to query it. They didn't know how to write a SQL query or how to search effectively. And there was a book written years ago called Google Hacks, and it was basically how you could do URL injections into the Google URL to find information that wasn't just available in the search box. And I think that we're going back to that kind of world, but it's going to be AI that is going to be able to do all that and find that. So one, bias data, right? I think that we'll get a bias agent that will go out and it will identify all that bias data and be able to clean it up. within the organization. So I absolutely do. I don't think they're here today, maybe not even next year. And that's why people do need to clean up their data estate themselves today. And that's why I go back to the Power Platform's a data story, not an app story. That fundamentally, the data's got to be sorted. But yes, in time, I believe that AI would handle that for us. That's why I think the future with AI is going to be pretty awesome, because where humans have failed in so many areas, I think AI can learn from those failings and go, hey, we could do this better.
But get your data sorted now and you've got a competitive advantage 100%. In the short term, at least.
A lot of the work I'm doing with Microsoft right now is all around and dealing and engaging with executives and what's the challenge. The number one motivator for AI is FOMO. They're worried their competitors are going to get ahead of them, because and they should be concerned about that, because I think that industries will disappear because of this tool sets that a small business now can have, can create the next billion-dollar company without putting the people power on to do it. In fact, Sam Altman in February this year came out and said, I think we're going to, in the next period of time, we'll see the first billionaire created that will have a company of one. They'll be the founder and no other employees, but they'll be a billion-dollar business.
I'm trying really hard.
I mean, what you can do with agents and scaling, right, is just mind-blowing. Like, I'm preparing for that world right now, as in, because the concept of autonomous agents are not here yet. The marketing's here, just not the reality. And so I'm doing everything I can to prepare and put the legwork in for the reality, which I reckon will come towards the end of 2025.
I want to pick up on, and you briefly just mentioned it again then, on what I think is a key point when we think about small to medium businesses and education providers. And you said about, don't just ignore the marketing. And actually, we say it, me and David say it to each other a lot. We've tried to do a lot with, well, as everyone is, with Copilot Studio, and particularly in the education world, and quickly discovered quite a few limits to what can be done. And we kind of say, you know, discover what it can't do before you worry about what it can do. And, you know, and I think that's really important, because I'm particularly thinking in education, when you're still getting kind of like your salesman come and knock on the door and selling you, you know, a brand new system for timetabling or one for curriculum planning. And, you know, out of the box, or, you know, on the brochure, it looks fantastic. But once you start embedding that into your organization and start using it, you quickly discover, oh, it doesn't link with our student record system, or it doesn't actually work well with this, or actually we look at timetabling a bit differently, and actually I needed this. And so I think it's really important that, you know, again, thinking of these small to medium businesses, thinking of education providers, that have a look, you know, whatever product you're using, whether it's Microsoft or not, discover what it can't do and then worry about what it can do afterwards. I think it's a really key point.
Yeah. So important, though, that you have discovered it yourself, that it's not theory.
Yes.
Right? Yes. To be able to understand those limits. But, you know, Copilot Studio, I think anybody that's has a career in the space, if you're not in Copilot Studio regularly and finding all the edges and where to bump into the walls and where the cliff drops, et cetera, you're not in it enough. It's such an important part of your tool set in the low code world, and then Azure AI Studio if you're in the pro code side of things.
Yeah, 100%. Before we finish up, I wanted to ask you a question that we ask everyone. It's really interesting to discover everyone's answer, because it's always very different. What is your favorite Microsoft application right now? And you can't say Dynamics, unless say you can't say Copilot either. What are you using maybe daily? I know before the podcast started, we mentioned OneNote. You know, is there something that you're using daily that you absolutely love and you can't live without?
No, if I can't use Copilot, as in my go-to tools is definitely Microsoft Teams, without a doubt, as an interface layer. But what I've been getting into more and more is the project tool, you know, a planner. Been using that a lot more. And the other thing I've been using more and more is Loop. Loop is so sick. It's so awesome what you can do. And if you have a look at Copilot and how you use Copilot now in the pages, the actual artifact it creates is a loop artifact. And that is so cool. I love how this orchestration is happening. Do we need more extensibility? Do we need it to go further? Absolutely. But where that's going, I think it just, yeah, it's amazing.
Do you know, one of our guests, when asked that question, said OneDrive. Yeah, because if I can't save a file anywhere, I'm done. Forget everything else.
So OneDrive is my second brain. So that's the other thing I'm preparing for AI, is creating a second brain, a digital brain. And OneDrive, my personal OneDrive, is that. I have a four-folder structure, and everything fits in that four-folder structure. So OneDrive is critical to everything I'm doing. If you want to know the presentation I'm working on right now, it's in folder number 2, projects, and there will be the presentation I'm currently working on. When I've retired that presentation, I know that folder number 4, archives, it will be under the archive presentation folder there. No matter what companies I go through or whatever, that's where those artifacts are. Then there's a resources and things like, you know, when my profile pic or anything like that, that I need it, it's always in that, there's an inbox and then those other 3 folders, and my second brain is there, and I'm preparing for when I can train AI on all that. And I've been storing that, though, for 20 years in other tools. Every email, every medical receipt, every receipt, I document it all, because one day I'm going to feed it into AI and AI is going to tell me who I am.
I can see OneDrive getting traction in our question, you know, Matt. I can see it moving. Mark, it's been a real pleasure having you with us on the pod. Thanks for sparing the time in your busy schedule for Mastering Mondays.